Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Power, Sex, Suicide, Mitochondria and the Meaning of Life, by Nick Lane, narrated by Nigel Patterson. Preface. In The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Ford Prefect spends 15 years researching his revision to the guide's entry on the Earth, which originally read Harmless. His long essay on the subject is edited down by the guide to read Mostly Harmless. I suspect that too many new editions suffer a similar fate, if not through absurd editing decisions, at least through a lack of meaningful change in content. As it happens, nearly 15 years have passed since the first edition of Power, Sex, Suicide was published, and I am resisting the temptation to make any lame revisions. Some say that even Darwin lessened the power of his arguments in The Origin of Species through his multiple revisions, in which he dealt with criticisms and sometimes shifted his views in the wrong direction. I prefer my original to speak for itself, even if it turns out to be wrong. Let me give one example why. This book is about mitochondria, the tiny powerhouses of our cells that provide essentially all the energy and many of the molecular building blocks needed for us to remain alive. They derive from bacteria that took up residence inside a host cell some 1.5 to 2 billion years ago, and retain a tiny but vitally important genome of their own. This mitochondrial genome is inherited from our mothers alone, in her egg cells. The father's mitochondrial genome, in the sperm, is destroyed. That sexual asymmetry is nearly universal across complex life, and is one of the deepest distinctions between the sexes. Females pass on their mitochondria, males do not, even in microscopic single-celled organisms, where there is no other visible difference between sexes. What is less certain is exactly why. In part 6 of this book, I discuss work suggesting that having two sexes enables natural selection to choose the best mitochondrial genes. Isolating a single type of mitochondrial DNA from a single parent allows it to be test-driven to see how well it works with the rest of the genes in the nucleus of the new individual. But I also noted that there is a potential problem here, because we inherit two sets of nuclear genes, one set from each of our parents. So what happens if one of these sets of nuclear genes works well with our mitochondrial genes, but the other set doesn't? I suggested that some of the father's nuclear genes, those that interact directly with mitochondria, might be switched off or imprinted, allowing optimization of mitochondrial function. But since writing the book, I learned that this is not true. There is not a jot of evidence for imprinting of any paternal genes in this case. These things rankle. Since then, I have spent 7 years working on this question with a good colleague at University College London, Andrew Pomiankowski, and drawn in several highly gifted students. I thought we had figured out the answer. We realized that sex and two sexes serve two different purposes. Sex is all about generating differences between individuals in their nuclear genes, making each of us genetically unique. If we were all clones, we could all be wiped out by the same virulent disease, perhaps contracted from a dirty telephone. As it is, the innumerable differences between individuals mean that we each present a subtly different face to the changing environment, for better or worse. Some of us will survive, to die another day. But having sex does not demand that there should be two sexes. In many respects, that is the worst of all possible worlds. From an evolutionary point of view, it would be better if everybody were the same sex, or if, mechanical issues aside, there were lots of different sexes. Then individuals could procreate with more or less everyone, not merely half the population. So why do most species have two sexes? After a lot of modelling, using the equations of population genetics, we realise that the answer is that two sexes generate differences between individuals in their mitochondrial genes. It's so simple. We each have two genomes, mitochondrial and nuclear. Sex enables natural selection to operate on genes in the nucleus. Two sexes allow selection to act on mitochondrial genes, QED. And then I came across recent work from Antonio Enriquez, a molecular biologist working in Madrid. Enriquez, too, notes that having two sets of nuclear genes that both interact with the mitochondrial genome could cause problems. He, too, agrees that there is no evidence to suggest that paternal genes interacting with mitochondria are switched off. Instead, he calls on a slightly different phenomenon known as monoallelic expression, in which only one of the two nuclear copies is switched on, but the copy that is turned on or off is random and may differ from one cell to the next. That is harder to detect, and requires sophisticated methods to sequence the transcripts of genes in single cells. Lots of single cells. Luckily, Enriquez has this power to hand in his lab, and in a few years' time we should know the answer. In the meantime, I'm back to square one. Nearly 15 years ago, I wrote that one of the two nuclear copies of genes interacting directly with mitochondria might be switched off. That's still true. Now, I must alter the word imprinting to monoallelic expression, harmless to mostly harmless. But if I had revised this book a year ago, I would have made it less correct than it had previously been. It's a mug's game. That's not to say there haven't been any exciting developments since 2005. There have been plenty. It's just that most carry some measure of uncertainty, and were touched on at least as an idea back then. Let me run through a few of my favourite examples, and give you a sense of how things have changed since 2005. More than anything else, this book is about the origins of complex life. To be honest, the full force of this theme only hit me when I was writing the book. It is nominally about a tiny compartment of the cell, after all, and I have been revolving around these same questions ever since. The reason for this confabulation relates to the acquisition of mitochondria. What sort of cell originally played host to the bacteria that eventually became our mitochondria? In the book, I advocate a powerful counterintuitive hypothesis proposed by the pioneering biochemists Bill Martin and Miklos Müller, known as the hydrogen hypothesis. The idea is counterproductive because it rejects the apparently central role of oxygen in the evolution of complexity, as I had previously assumed, having written an earlier book on oxygen, instead placing the nub of the deal on hydrogen gas. That matters less for what it is than what it is not. According to Bill Martin, the host cell was not a complex phagocyte, a cell that engulfed other cells for a living, but a morphologically simple, self-sufficient, autotrophic cell that grew from gases alone. It lacked the complexity of our own eukaryotic cells, from the Greek for true nucleus. The idea was controversial then, and is no less controversial now, and the evidence for or against remains equivocal. But the essence of the idea, that the host was a simple cell lacking eukaryotic complexity, now looks more secure with the discovery of a group of cells known as the Lokiarchaeota, or Loki for short. Loki shares so many similarities in its genes with complex eukaryotic cells that there can be little doubt that the host cell that acquired mitochondria was closely related to it. Loki is as close to a smoking gun as we are likely to get for an episode that happened close to 2 billion years ago. Yet Loki is also utterly tantalising. It was detected in the muds around Loki's castle, a submarine hydrothermal system located between Norway and Greenland. I say detected, not discovered, because we still don't know what Loki looks like. Everything we know about it comes from gene sequences pieced together laboriously into full or nearly full genomes. Various related cells have been detected since then, which are now all grouped together into the Asgard superphylum, after the home of the Norse gods. Yet the same mystique applies to them all. None has been isolated or cultured or viewed with certainty under a microscope. They exist only as cryptic gene sequences, encoding, what exactly. We don't know what they are or how they live. From what little we do know, though, it seems likely that they are small cells, simple in their morphology, as predicted by the hydrogen hypothesis. There's even a suggestion that they can grow using hydrogen. Why does that matter? It matters because, if true, it implies that all eukaryotic complexity arose in the aftermath of an intimate relationship between two simple cells, or, more precisely, populations of simple cells. One of those cells went on to become the mitochondria. The other was ultimately transformed into a complex host cell, the likes of which the world had never seen before. Nor has such cellular complexity ever arisen again. The origin of complex life on Earth was a singular event. The discovery of Loki is exciting, and will no doubt teach us much, but in broad terms, Loki chimes with the themes elaborated here. It emphasizes them. They are more, not less, likely to be true. Another exciting recent development that emphasizes a theme explored in this book relates to the temperature at which mitochondria operate. Just a few months ago, as I write, Pierre Rustin and colleagues published an extraordinary paper that seems to show that mitochondria are maintained at nearly 50 degrees Celsius, around 10 degrees Celsius hotter than the rest of the body. These findings look scarcely credible and are challenged by some physicists who doubt that such extreme temperature gradients could be maintained across such short distances. Yet there is no doubt but that the science is well done. The question revolves around the nanoscale engineering of fluorescent probes that can be targeted to the inner sanctum of mitochondria, the matrix, where the intensity of fluorescence reports back on the local temperature, or at least it is supposed to. We don't know for sure if temperature is the only thing that these probes report on, nor do we know what temperature really means in a small confined space crammed full of gyrating protein machinery. One marvellous molecular machine, the ATP synthase, is a rotating protein motor that spins at 400 revolutions per second. There are tens of thousands of them in each mitochondrion. Surely they must agitate nearby water molecules, stirring up molecular motion that might be detected as heat, also a form of molecular motion, by the dye. In any case, even if the dye is not strictly accurate, it seems likely that mitochondria are hotter than we had thought. I'd like to think that this will draw attention back to some older questions in biology that I discuss in this book, notably the origins of endothermy, warm-bloodedness. We already knew that most heat derives from the mitochondria, and that much of the temperature difference between reptiles and mammals, or birds, relates to the number of mitochondria. Mammals tend to have about 5 times as many mitochondria as equivalent reptiles. Why? One possibility is that having more mitochondria increases stamina and supports much more sustained activity. But there has always been a puzzling disconnect between maximal metabolic rates, supported by the cardiovascular system and skeletal muscles, and the resting metabolic rate, which reflects the activity of visceral organs such as liver or intestines. There is no obvious reason why evolving a high maximal metabolic rate should force up the resting metabolic rate. The two could theoretically be disconnected, and there are arguments about whether theropod dinosaurs did indeed disconnect the two. Recently, Andy Clark, now retired from the British Antarctic Survey, pointed out that the maximal metabolic rate is a red herring. What matters is not maximal performance, but ticking over, not a gallop, but a canter. Of course, maximal metabolic rate is subject to selection too, but that does not drive the evolution of endothermy directly. To sustain steady activity in the field, as animals forage or hunt or compete for mates, demands continuous metabolic activity and the processing of waste, which in turn requires more mitochondria in visceral organs. That means the resting metabolic rate is necessarily linked with the field metabolic rate, because both draw on the same set of mitochondria in the visceral organs. Selection for more visceral mitochondria increases both stamina and heat, making our costly 24/7 lifestyle possible. If Clark is right, and I think he is, then there must be very tight controls over the number of mitochondria in our organs, and there might well be unexpected costs or benefits to any therapies that alter this number. I discuss some of these in the book, and those arguments become more pointed if mitochondria really do generate a lot more heat than we had appreciated. One fact to conjure with is this. Selection for greater stamina over several generations in mice leads to longer lifespan and better health. As I sit at my keyboard, I'm thinking, keep moving. In the final part of this book, I discuss mitochondrial diseases and their relationship with aging and death. Mitochondrial diseases number amongst the most devastating conditions imaginable, for the simple reason that mitochondria are so simple to the life and death of organisms, providing almost all the energy needed to live, but also triggering the death program, apoptosis, in cells that can't make ends meet. The reason behind these terrible conditions may be simple. The reality is complex beyond measure. These diseases can be caused by mutations in mitochondrial genes or those in the nucleus that encodes proteins targeted to the mitochondria. They can even be unmasked by apparently trivial incompatibilities between mitochondrial and nuclear genes. Trivial in the sense that there is nothing wrong with either genome, they just don't work well together. There are also differences between men and women in susceptibility to mitochondrial diseases, with some conditions being 5 times more common in males, an aching tragedy known as mother's curse, as mitochondria are inherited from the mother only. The perplexing complexity of mitochondrial diseases is magnified by the number of mitochondria. We each inherit hundreds of thousands of copies of mitochondrial DNA in the egg cell. A particular mutation may occur in just a few copies, or in hundreds, thousands, or tens of thousands of copies. These mutations often segregate unexpectedly into different tissues, and even interfere with each other in ways that can cause heart disease, muscular degeneration, and learning difficulties in mice. Mitochondrial conditions may kill in early childhood, or with little warning in middle age, or might gradually undermine health in normal aging. Mitochondrial dysfunction undoubtedly contributes to common conditions, including cancer, Alzheimer's disease, and diabetes. What might have been slightly tenuous claims in 2005 now probably reflect the mainstream view. One of the most important and controversial breakthroughs of the past few years is mitochondrial therapy. In the book, I discuss a discredited fertility treatment called ooplasmic transfer, in which mitochondria are transferred into an oocyte, the egg cell, of the woman seeking treatment. While some apparently healthy children were born using this technique, it necessarily produces a mixture of mitochondria, heteroplasmy. The consequences of heteroplasmy were uncertain at the time, but are now known to be hazardous in mice. The technique was prudently banned by the US Food and Drug Administration, FDA, in the noughties. Far more promising as a treatment for mitochondrial disease is pronuclear or spindle transfer, which involves the transfer of the nucleus from a zygote, or fertilized egg cell, into a recipient egg cell that contains mitochondria from a healthy donor. In principle, this method does not produce mixtures of mitochondria. In practice, it may do anyway, as a few mitochondria can cling to the nucleus and be amplified during embryonic development. But the method has attracted press attention because it forms 3 parent embryos. The nuclear DNA of the would-be parents is supplemented by the mitochondrial DNA of the donor. While there is potential for complications through inadvertent heteroplasmy or incompatibilities between the donor mitochondria and the nucleus, the scope for good seems to me to far outweigh the potential for harm, which in a worst-case scenario would be essentially the same mitochondrial disease that the procedure aims to cure. Some people understandably harbour ethical concerns over genetic engineering in humans, But in the UK, these issues have been addressed over two decades through public and legal consultations, steered with enormous sensitivity, dedication and skill by Douglas Turnbull in Newcastle. The claim that mitochondria are simply batteries and don't alter our personalities in any way is in one sense true. Most of the subtle differences between individuals are indeed encoded by genes in the nucleus and are not affected by mitochondrial therapy. In my view, mitochondria are not merely batteries, but are better seen as flux capacitors, which tune our performance according to need, switching nuclear genes on or off as necessary. And if they are switching nuclear genes on or off, they probably do affect our personality. But in any case, when the batteries die on your computer or car or phone, you will immediately remember that they are far more important than trivial differences in brand. In the same way, energy, health and vitality underscore everything in our lives. To live life to the full, to develop our personalities as we might wish, we need functional batteries. Finally, a note on oxygen toxicity. I have long argued, and in this book too, that reactive forms of oxygen gas, known as free radicals, really do affect lifespan and health, but that antioxidants won't extend our lives as they interfere with signalling, and may, if anything, have the opposite effect. It is hard to prove that statement one way or another, but the persistent failure of antioxidants to improve any health outcomes, along with many other equivocal details, has led many to doubt that free radicals have anything to do with ageing. I confess I was beginning to wonder myself. There is no doubt that oxygen can be toxic. Breathing pure oxygen at high pressure will produce brutal convulsions, while the devastating burns linked with some forms of porphyria, which are induced by the phototoxicity of porphyrin intermediates, is wrought by a violently reactive form of oxygen called singlet oxygen. Radiation poisoning is also largely provoked by oxygen-free radicals. But these extreme cases are hardly representative of the imperceptible slowness of aging. Are we really undone by breathing? The answer really might be yes. The Harvard mitochondrial biologist Vamsi Mutha and colleagues reported some extraordinary findings in 2016. Mice with a mitochondrial disease approximating to Lee syndrome die within 3 months, showing severe neuromuscular degeneration similar to that seen in infants with the condition, who heartbreakingly die from respiratory failure within 2 or 3 years of birth. The problem in mice related to how they dealt with oxygen. Raising them in a hypoxic tent, breathing an atmosphere containing 11% oxygen, equivalent to the high mountain communities in Nepal or Peru, enabled them to live quite normal lives. They moved around relatively freely and developed less severe symptoms of the disease many months later. But if these Lee syndrome mice were placed in tents under mildly elevated oxygen, 55%, not enough to harm healthy mice, they were desperately affected, surviving barely a month. Plainly, the mice could not cope with oxygen, but in this case the effect can be attributed squarely to how the mitochondria process oxygen. A frustrating drawback is that the episodic use of hypoxic tents is not beneficial, nor is intermediate hypoxia therapy, say 17% oxygen. There seems to be a lower threshold for protection. Even so, these findings are illuminating. I have never seen so clear a case that breathing oxygen kills. Antioxidants can make it worse. Another colleague at University College London, Florencia Camus, has been working on mitochondrial function in fruit flies with mild incompatibilities between their mitochondrial and nuclear genes. The old joke has it that time flies like an arrow, but fruit flies like a banana. Some of these flies actually do fly like a banana. They can barely get airborne if given an antioxidant at moderate dose. Just the females. Ironically, we had been interested in these fruit flies because the males suffer from a mild form of mother's curse. Their fertility is lower than flies with well-matched mitochondria, and the problem seems to relate to oxygen toxicity in their testes. The antioxidants seemed to work. In this case, it improved male fertility. Yet the same dose of the same antioxidant killed almost all the females, apparently by suppressing their respiration. It didn't affect the females with well-matched mitochondria at all. We have not published this yet, and we are still trying to figure out the mechanism. I mention it here because the implications are important. Drug responses, whether good or catastrophically bad, can depend on mitochondrial interactions that are barely detectable under normal circumstances. Is this just the tip of an iceberg? The title of this book might be a little swaggering. Faint-hearted mitochondriacs can be embarrassed when reading it on public transport. I apologise. Most people remember just one word from the title. An enjoyable review quipped that I gave up smoking after reading Nick Lane's book on oxygen, so I approached his book on sex with some trepidation. Now that I am older, I can reflect on whether the title is just swaggering or conceals a deeper truth, as I'd like to think. In writing this preface, I'm struck that these ideas have not faded with time or the prodigious advance of science. Mitochondria really do give meaning to life, or at least help us to understand life, which ought to be the same thing. I hope this book will illumine your own quest for meaning. Nick Lane, London, March 2018. Introduction. Mitochondria, clandestine rulers of the world. Mitochondria are tiny organelles inside cells that generate almost all our energy in the form of ATP. On average, there are 300 to 400 in every cell, giving 10 million billion in the human body. Essentially, all complex cells contain mitochondria. They look like bacteria, and appearances are not deceptive. They were once free-living bacteria, which adapted to life inside larger cells some 2 billion years ago. They retain a fragment of a genome as a badge of former independence. Their tortuous relations with their host cells have shaped the whole fabric of life, from energy, sex, and fertility, to cell suicide, aging, and death. Mitochondria are a badly kept secret. Many people have heard of them for one reason or another. In newspapers and some textbooks, they are summarily described as the powerhouses of life, tiny power generators inside living cells that produce virtually all the energy we need to live. There are usually hundreds or thousands of them in a single cell, where they use oxygen to burn up food. They are so small that 1 billion of them would comfortably fit in a grain of sand. The evolution of mitochondria fitted life with a turbocharged engine, revved up and ready for use at any time. All animals, the most slothful included, contain at least some mitochondria. Even sessile plants and algae use them to augment the quiet hum of solar energy in photosynthesis. Some people are more familiar with the expression mitochondrial Eve. She was supposedly the most recent ancestor common to all the peoples living today, if we trace our genetic inheritance back up the maternal line, from child to mother to maternal grandmother and so on, back into the deep mists of time. Mitochondrial Eve, the mother of all mothers, is thought to have lived in Africa perhaps 170,000 years ago, and is also known as African Eve. We can trace our genetic ancestry in this way, because all mitochondria have retained a small quota of their own genes, which are usually passed on to the next generation only in the egg cell, not in the sperm. This means that mitochondrial genes act like a female surname, which enables us to trace our ancestry down the female line in the same way that some families try to trace their descent down the male line from William the Conqueror, or Noah, or Muhammad. Recently, some of these tenets have been challenged, but by and large, the theory stands. Of course, the technique not only gives an idea of our ancestry, but it also helps clarify who were not our ancestors. According to mitochondrial gene analysis, Neanderthal man didn't interbreed with modern Homo sapiens, but was driven to extinction at the margin of Europe. Mitochondria have also made the headlines for their use in forensics, to establish the true identity of people or corpses, including several celebrated cases. Again, the technique draws on their
sample complete. Ready to continue?